Well, welcome to the D&K Riposte Non-League Show. And, of course, in association with Square Media and, of course, Riposte Retail Solutions. And we're here tonight. Unfortunately, the internet's playing up again. So we're only on Facebook tonight. And, of course, we'll be on Audio Boom later on in podcast later on as well. But, of course, joining me tonight on show 299 is two complete and utter living legends. And so we'll start off, if we can, at the top end. And was that your dad, Randall, or your mum that just gave you a laugh?
That is my dad. Laughing.
There's another living legend with him as well.
It's a legend that they got. How rude.
So, of course... Ali, of course, is joining us tonight. And, of course, also as well, in the bottom of the screen, as you can see, of course, he's the living legend himself, Mr. Keith Hackett. And welcome, Keith. Welcome, Ali.
Thank you.
Hi, David. How are you?
Not too bad, mate. Not too bad. But I suppose one of the things we're going to be joined by Paul Michael from Merthyr Tydfil. He's going to come and join us. Later on, he's coming back from Swindon Supermarine. So he will be back with us. He'll be with us as soon as possible from his long journey today. And unfortunately for him, not a fruitful journey to Swindon Supermarine either. But hopefully he'll be in good spirits when he joins us later on. And I suppose one of the things that has come up over the weekend, if we can, Keith, we can start with this first, because it was quite a serious incident that came on. And for me, we've seen what's happened over the weekend in one of the games in the Southern League at the weekend on Saturday. And I suppose one of my biggest things for me is, guys, please, 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 out there, let's get these defibrillators into your club if you haven't got one already. Let's make sure that everybody in your club, you know, gets first aid trained, because as we saw on Saturday, how vital these defibrillators are and how vital it is to have people there that are CPR trained inside your club. So please, just for myself, and I know Ali and Keith will back me up with this, you know, please, guys and girls, please make sure that you're getting this equipment into your clubs. And, you know, if you haven't, make sure you're contacting your leagues and making sure you get one in there as soon as you possibly can, and even sort out some training sessions as well to actually learn how to do CPR, because as we saw, it is absolutely vital that this happens. And, you know, all our best wishes go to the Hertford Town players, you know, and a massive get well soon to him. You know, massive well done to the players, and also as well to the two physios in the game as well, that saved the young man's life on Saturday. And our thoughts and prayers are with him and everybody at Hertford Town as well. You know, with everything that happened in what had to be an absolutely awful experience for everybody involved. And we do wish everybody at theirs, and I think it was it Aylesbury they were playing, or Dunstable? I always get them muddled up, but were there as well. And we'll just double check in. I should have known this before we came on, but I'm at Dunstable as well. So every wishes, you know, and our thoughts are with everybody at Dunstable and at Hertford Town, and hopefully we can see everybody back playing soon, and hopefully that the effects are not long lasting for everybody that saw the incident that happened at the weekend. Ali, I mean, with yourself, I mean, I think you've been in that situation yourself before as well. How sort of tough is it, and how sort of, what's the name, would you say, is to people to get those defibrillators into their clubs?
It's probably the most essential thing you ever buy as a football club, I think. In you know, we all get caught up on buying VOs, or we've got on player vests or tracking systems, or dare I say, even like things like new turnstiles. I mean, what's more important than saving somebody's life when the moment comes? I think that it's something that even you can't even put a figure on how important that is in a football game. I mean, touch wood, hopefully it would never be something you ever use as a club. It'd be that thing that sits there gathering dust all season, but it's important that when it's needed, it's there. It's like anything, really. But even like the physio, I suppose, it's important that they're there when they're needed. You know, they might sit there on the bench gathering dust all season, that physio, hopefully. But sadly, we're getting called on more and more, I think, in recent times, David. Well, essentially, I've been doing football physiotherapy about 15 years now, something like that. And in the beginning of my career, I would have said it was reasonably unheard of. Maybe you get the odd crowd event if you're very unlucky. And now I seem to hear about it every other week. So either we're hearing more about it because there's more publicity around it, or something's changing, I don't know. But I think it's just so vital. I think speaking as being involved in situations that it's nerve-wracking for the physios involved, for the players, for the fans, for the whole club, and even for the whole football family. You know, no one wants to go football to not come back again afterwards. That's not why we're here. You know, none of us want that. Mm. From the groundsman to the ref to the physio to the fans sitting in row D, no one wants to see a player collapse and be incredibly unwell on a pitch. So, as you said, all our thoughts go out to the lad involved. But I think it's another little wake up call for football for me that we've ignored a few of them now. How much worse does it have to get? I don't know. But ultimately, the key message is always going to be just make sure you've got the right equipment now, whether that's a stretcher, defib, whatever it might be. But our players are our greatest assets on a football pitch. We should be looking after them, is my viewpoint, sort of as a caption, you know?
And I mean, how do you, and I suppose on the other front of it is how do you get over something like that as some, you know, as a physio and maybe as a referee in key situation, but also as well, you know, as players and spectators around that ground? I mean, how, when you see something like that, I mean, that's something that must scar you for quite some time.
It does. I think that there's an important thing to take a moment to reflect and almost debrief. I work in a hospital outside of football, so I hate to say it. Been there, done that. Got the T-shirt quite a few times, sadly, David. But I think it's a case of that even if you're on your first resuscitation or on your 89th resuscitation, it feels the same. Regardless of the outcome, it always feels atrocious afterwards. So it's taking a moment to be kind to yourself, to talk about it, to allow yourself the moment to be human, to feel, to reflect. Most importantly, to come together as a team. So we had two events last season at Barking. And the first thing I did was check on my players afterwards and say, like, hi, guys, you're okay. You know, I know it's horrible. I'm here for you. But I also took, like, 5 minutes to myself to go and sit alone with a can of Coke because when adrenaline's kicking out, you feel a bit more rubbish. So a bit of sugar always helps me, personally. You can get Coke or Pepsi or even just a sugary tea, if that's your preference. I don't know. But basically, just take a minute to yourself. And you're allowed to feel upset about this. But the best thing you can do with that upset, and I know it's controversial to say it, and I've said it on Twitter before, that if these moments upset you enough, then take action. Because the best thing you can do when something bad happens is to don't let it happen again. You know, make sure you've got the right, because the more prepared you are, the better you feel when these moments happen. You know, if you're standing in a field and there's no one around you and you're on your own and you've got nothing to do with, then it probably isn't going to end well. But if you've got the right equipment, the right personnel, and everyone's together as a team and they're working on that moment, and the action plan, the emergency action plan is spot on, then you feel so much better in that moment. I'm probably the same as refs, I think, Keith, from your point of view, that the more prepared you are for that moment of terror happening, the better it almost goes, I find. You know, you've almost got to practice it. I practice it in hospitals, so we are prepared for these moments.
Yeah. I think that visualisation is what we use as referees often in these in various situations to improve refereeing. I think you're absolutely right that clubs need to have a very clear procedure. Sometimes you could the physio can be dealing with the player on the field of play when somebody ought to be making that call for an ambulance to arrive as quickly as possible. Because time is so important. I must admit, when I started refereeing my career in age 16, and when I was 18, someone tapped me on the shoulder and said, I think you should do a first aid course. And I took that first aid course, and what was amazing was within a matter of weeks, one of the club officials who I knew quite well sadly collapsed on the pitch. We were unable to recover him. The ambulance was taking too much time. I think what was really important at that time, and you've touched on it, is the impact that that had on players. And it was such that I decided at that point the game was not the first criteria here. I abandoned the match because the players were not in a fit state. So I think it is important. I think, you know, when we, you know, that I think the game is getting quicker. Mm. We've had in recent weeks hot temperatures. It's all about preparation. It's always about someone in the club having a skill set to recognise, look, drinks must be taken. We must have those breaks. And it doesn't matter how many they are. Yeah, okay, some clubs and some leagues will say three in a match. If there is a medic around, I will ask for that advice. And if the medic, I keep used to keep one eye on the medic, physio, and if they gave me the nod, the game was stopped and refreshments taken. Hydration is obviously important. But this goes a bit further, doesn't it? Because the higher you go up in the competition, the more you need to take into account that, you know, you have different ages of spectators coming to games. And all of a sudden, as we've seen in professional games, there's a switch, and the requirement of those club officials, those club experts like yourself, Ali, to jump in into the crowd and sort out an illness that's occurred with a spectator. So clubs, if they haven't got a defibrillator, there's methods of getting them. There's funding available to aid that. And yeah, I think it's important. Don't allow them to dust off. Put them in a prominent position. I think that we see telephone boxes now up and down the country with defibs in. We see them on street corners with things. So I think they're becoming now more and more visible. But then I think the important thing is to have more than one person trained in your club. Hopefully there's four or five that you might be able to rely on, because, you know, my own club, we have 20 teams, you know, age five upwards. And not always is there a skilled, qualified physio present.
Do you think those defibs and stuff like that now should be almost, how can we say, almost free, almost sort of like, or the lowest price you could possibly do them, so that, you know, clubs can actually to buy them? And I suppose the second thing as well is, and again, talk us through it, because I, and Ali, you may know maybe a bit more than Keith, I'm not too sure, but I look at these defibs when they're out in the street, like Keith says, and they're in the phone box, but they're locked and you've got to have a code. Well, someone's having an heart attack on the floor, you're going to get a bit flustered trying to work out, well, how do I get this thing open?
Basically, to get the cut, I mean, a lot of them, their community, sadly, the reason why they're locked up is because people nick them they break them, and they, you can only hope that in that situation, they're the ones that have the heart attack, but sadly, it's never how it works out. But I think, basically, you call 111, and they will provide you with that code for that defib. So if you tell them you're having a heart attack, and say someone's having a heart attack, there's a defib here, this is the, it's got like a little on the, if you ever take the chance, have a look at one when you walk past it, is my best advice. A lot of clubs, basically community clubs, have got them. Big yellow box normally. They have a little code saying the area code where it is. You give them the code and they'll give you the code to open it.
Yeah.
Long story short. Another one we have at Barking isn't locked. It's just, it's on the wall still. Because I prefer it being visible. So, because I said, if it's in the crowd and I'm on, I'm in bugger, hey, it's going to take you a minute to get the message around to me. There's a problem.
Yeah.
Someone can go in that defib and then call me and we can run almost parallel to each other and get it there together. Yeah, it's really sad for people to face them, but sadly, people do nonsense, don't they, in the street?
Do you also think as well, though, Ali, that, that maybe, you know, the leagues that are local to us, you know, is the Kent League, there's the, you know, Essex Senior League, there's the East Mid League, the Southern League, the Northern League. Do you not think that maybe that sort of thing where I've lost my track of thought there, but do you not think there should be somebody put out there that, right, okay, we're going to be doing this training session this day to get more physios involved as well? Because, you know, there's still clubs around, as you know now, that, you know, there's physios that are retiring this year, have already retired, or this one's gone to that one and this one's gone to this one. You know, and it's like, you know, as we know with Courtney, you know, Courtney's moved from one club to another club, and it was almost like an Oscar ceremony when she's actually announced it. Everybody's gone potty because, oh, great, we've got Courtney. This is fantastic. Yeah. You know, and rightly so, because she's a fantastic, you know, physio like Ali. But do you not think it should be a situation where the league should be looking at this, especially after this weekend, and going, guys, we need to make sure that we put an advert out that we actually pay almost for the courses? Because most of the leagues, and Anthony will probably kill me for saying this, and Nick, because they're on next week, but, you know, they have that sort of slash money. Do you not think it's one of those things where they could get hold of the situation and say, look, we're going to give each, you know, pay for a course or what, whatever it might be?
I'll be honest, I think there's nothing to stop all these leagues, and whether that's the Premier League down or the local Sunday League up, from bulk buying advice that is, and ingrating into clubs. I think the key thing really I always think is the DPMs are fantastic and they are life-saving, but without the ability, knowledge and confidence as well to be the person that goes and grabs it and puts it on somebody, they become useless. So I think unless you've trained people, you've given them the skills, and that includes everything. I mean, I've got a player, for example, at Barking, who has a severe anaphylaxis, so he has a severe reaction to well, nuts in his case. Last week, I spent time with my players teaching their dip pins because I might not be there that day. I might be on the team coach and I'm on the motorway somewhere else, or dare I say, I've gone to the bathroom for 5 seconds. And if you're the person that I want you to be able to get a pin and put it in his leg and save his life, you know? So yeah. I think it's about us upskilling everyone. I think players should know what to do. I think the coaches should know what to do. I think refs, I think the barman, I think the kit man, I think the groundsman. I think every single person in this country should know how to do CPR. Personally speaking, and that's good without a DFib as well. I think that ultimately the key thing is DFibs are great, but and every minute you don't have one, your success rate becomes 10% less. So they are incredibly vital. But ultimately, the best thing to do is if I had more than one person with me on a football pitch, so say there was two physios at the ground, I'd shout them and get my DFib and I'd get on the chest. I'd start doing CPR because that massively improves your being. If there's two of you there, brilliant. I mean, the main risk I've seen recently, David, is that I go to a ground, I'm the only physio there. And the other team haven't told me until kick off. So I get there and go, physio, go, oh no, he's not here tonight. Can you do it for us? So I've now got, I'm essentially now in my head looking after what, 30 odd players and the match officials as well, technically. They haven't got a physio here. You guys haven't got anybody there looking after you. And I know that ultimately I've got 2 minutes of CPR in my arms, you know, at a time. And I'm going to run out of juice pretty quickly. But it's things like the phone call. So who's going to phone the ambulance for me and tell them the right information? I can't stop what I'm doing here, saving a life, essentially, to do the phone call and make sure that the ambulance spot is clear and make sure that the gates are open and make sure that somebody guides the ambulance in. When you have a trauma in a hospital, you have 10 odd people turn up for a crash call, which is for CPR or for a cardiac arrest. And a football ground, especially at non-league, there's normally one physio there and they might not even be qualified, which frankly terrifies me. The new
Before Keith comes in, just let me introduce the man that's just joined us to the right of you there, Keith. Of course, he's the Merthyr Town manager, Paul Michael. So Paul, welcome. And I've been told by one of your famous fans that that everybody at Merthyr is over the moon to have you there.
Oh, hi, David. Yeah, well, they've been very receptive so far. I've had a great great reception since I've joined the club. And yeah, I can't thank the fans enough, really. We've lost today. So I've just got back off the coach. It was a little bit noisy. My reception wasn't very good on the coach. So I've waited until I've got back to my car to join you all tonight. But I'm not overly pleased with the start, but the supporters have been awesome. They've been great. Yeah.
Well, what we've been talking about, Paul, is, and I don't know if you saw it yourself in the South Central Division on Saturday, there was a very serious incident with one of the players at Hertford Town having a heart attack on the pitch, and a defib was used, and you know, thankfully, you know, after some very, very serious minutes and that happened on that, you know, on during the match, you know, he's still with us, which is, you know, we're all very, very thankful for, you know, in the football world. But you know, we were just saying, you know, about people being trained for using defibs and being able to do CPR, and maybe your famous fan won't be happy when I say this, but maybe some of the leagues should be, you know, helping out a little bit with monetary stuff to help train people and stuff. But I mean, within Merthyr, have you got that situation where you've got, you know, a trained physio, and you've also got, you know, anybody would be confident put into that situation, but you know, have you got the right people in the right places for an emergency situation like that?
Yeah, to be fair, Merthyr, I think we have, you know, touch wood, I never see that situation, but you know, I just caught a little bit of what Ali was saying there, and I understand the pressure that these guys and girls are under, feeling that they, you know, all the situation that they would have to manage in the, you know, in a very difficult non-league environment. But we've got, yeah, we've got qualified physio, we've got defibs at the ground, a couple of them, in fact. There are a number of other first aiders who are trained. We've got a couple of PE teachers on the staff, actually, which we've obviously kept our first aid training up to date. And then there's health and safety professionals in the background at the football club, which is, because the football club's a bit more fortunate than some of the others that I've worked at, in terms of there are more people behind the scenes and more people to be able to fill these roles. But certainly, you know, we're seeing it more and more often, and it is something that's, you know, we need to educate as many people, as many players, as many clubs on it as possible. Even, you know, of course, I wasn't sure about the situation in the South Central division recently. I know there was another one in the National League South at Chippenham a couple of weeks ago. And there's lots of things, of course, you know, can screening be extended? Can education in terms of caffeine intake and different things? I'm not talking about any specific situation that's happened over the last couple of weeks. Just want to clarify that. But players need to be aware of lots of things as much as possible. And the more resources clubs have, the better, I guess, in every way.
I mean, the one thing that... it's very interesting. Everybody's asked, we've got three sort of different views. You've got Paul, if you haven't mentioned, we've got Keith Hackett, ex Premier League ref, and of course, we've also got Ali as well. But we get to a situation with league rules where, you know, if we haven't got a referee, we can't play the game. If the change rooms are under a certain square footage, then, you know, you can't start the season. If you haven't got this, you know, if your pitch is not up to standard, you can't play at that level. You have to go down this way. How long is it going to be before we turn around and say, right, enough's enough? If you haven't got somebody that's trained in the medical side of it for the club, that your club can't actually start the season? You know, how close are we going to be getting to that scenario when we're getting players, you know, having serious issues on the pitch?
My honest answer? Do you want my nice answer?
No, go on. I mean, you say
honestly, it will never come, David. I think that there'll always be my. You want my honest opinion? I'd say you shouldn't start season unless you've got a defib at the ground. Personally, but unless you have got physically got a defib at the ground, you shouldn't be doing football at the ground. Not only for the first team, but for the youth teams and everyone else, that it should be at least a defib at every ground. Those would be a question I have onto the crowd as well, but that's a separate point. I think ultimately, there's not enough pieces to go around. We've seen it now that, you know, I won't lie, I did try and leave Barking in the summer, and frankly, there was not another physio around for miles. So ultimately, I chose to stay where I was. But pieces that they put out, they were leaving clubs, were getting thousands of messages from clubs, literally thousands. I think ultimately, physios have left the game for the reasons that everyone's left the game. That, you know, they're busy, they've gone to work in NHS now. COVID has taken a toll on them, and a lot of them go and work in the pro game now, because they can go and work for an academy, get lots more training, lots more facilities, maybe a bit extra money as well. Not that we do this job, but I think ultimately there'll never be a threshold for saying you must have a medically trained person. I think the threshold should be about having people who are first aid trained. I understand that everyone who's got a coaching badge should be first aid trained, and that should cover it. Whether or not coaches feel very confident doing that, I don't know. That's probably more for Paul to answer than me, but I know mine wouldn't be very confident if I wasn't there. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, Ali. That once you get to a certain level, you need your first aid up to date, but a very, very basic level of first aid that you have to do to get your coaching qualification. And I think we're fortunate, really, in that we've had people who've done more the longer 2-3 days training, and then just kept that topped up. But I agree with you in terms of defibs, like you need it in terms of the local community. And if football clubs and rugby clubs and everywhere around them have them, then everybody knows where they are. And I agree with you right the way down to grassroots, you know, parks level. You just need as many of them as possible. And, you know, we'll save so many lives across the country if they're accessible to everybody and they're everywhere. But of course, it's like everything, it's a matter of funding, and I suppose.
Okay.
I can remember many years ago when Peter Cech received a knock to the head in what was a sliding challenge. At that point, the physios came on. They managed to recover him, and then they literally threw him on a stretcher, took him across the pitch into the dressing room. At that point, the ambulance was called for, and then they realised, the medics did, that to get this player out of the stadium at Reading, they had to move across the football pitch, stop the game again, move him across the football pitch, and we were very lucky that this guy didn't die. The result of that was the Premier League had meetings with top doctors and various other people inside and outside the game. Then retraining of their staff took place within the clubs at Premier League and Football League level. And at that point, the Premier League decided that they would have their own doctor at the football match, paid for by them, that they would have an ambulance at the football match, paid for by them, and a senior paramedic, as well as the additional staff that's already there. They decided as insurance and took the responsibility that they would, in fact, not allow that type of, not incident, because these incidents do take place, but, you know, the simple thing like head restraint was not in place. This guy was placed on a stretcher without any head restraint, without. So therefore, when you watch this film, his head's bumping around and he's actually got a hole in his head at that particular time. So that's at the extreme. But what the Premier League has done since is to train, to continue to train, to have these people in place, as well as the club staff. Ali's quite right to encourage clubs to have trained staff within the academies, but that's cascaded down, you know. But ultimately, at the end of the day, there's going to be two teams of 11 players in the local park, yards and miles away from any form of defib and any form of medical assistance. And that is why I think the training element has to be at that end. It has to be, how can we ensure that kids, often watched by parents, can play in a safe environment? And that for me is the responsibility of everybody that plays, takes part in the game. You know, the need, those that have the wealth, you know, the Premier League that has the wealth, to cascade some of that money down, the local professional club to cascade some of the money down. I don't want to get into the politics, but, you know, I was in Athens this week with the chairman of a football club, a Premier League football club, and we're having a chat. He received, or his club received, 150 million before they'd even kicked a ball as part of the television monies this time round. So for me, I think some of that wealth has got to cascade down. And I think it's then got to fall down to the next level, to the next level, to the next level, so that we do have the least amount of exposure when either player, member of staff, fan is left in that position. There's a social responsibility here, I think. So I think that it's just the focus. This program is putting the focus on this situation, you know. And we saw at the beginning of the 2022 European Championships, how Anthony Taylor, when that player collapsed on the field of play, how he stepped away, but at the same time was organising and making certain that any delay in getting the right people to that player was avoided. And I think it was also interesting to see the players generally, okay, one clearly started doing CPR on the player himself because that player had been trained. But it is a speed here. It is recognising there's a problem and then dealing with it. But there are other things that happen in football. I can remember officiating a game between Norwich City and Ipswich Town. And Mishdi Avery of Ipswich jumped up to head a ball. He headed his opponent, collapsed to the ground. I semi-ignored it and allowed play to continue. When I looked round, this guy was struggling. And in fact, I'd got a huge blockage. And I, whether rightly or wrong at that time, I had been to the hospital, had done a first aid course. It certainly didn't cover the fact that I whipped my fingers down his throat to try and get some air relief, because his tongue hadn't gone back. I don't think it goes back, but it was blocking his airways. And this guy was rushed to the hospital. I can tell you that for the next 20 minutes, I hadn't got a clue what was going on as far as refereeing a football match. You know, and I looked back and thought, I'd have been better off taking the players off, allowing them a break and a bit of time to recover and get over that trauma that we'd all witnessed.
And I think as well, I think
that's the most important thing to do is to get the airway clear. Honestly, when I go into a picture, someone's collapsed. First thing I do is get the airway clear.
Amazing. I just did it naturally and without any.
It's get the old tilt in or chip. It's 101 physio. So well done you.
But I mean, I'll be honest.
I wasn't saying it for praise. I think it was just the fact that it happens, and these things aren't regular, fortunately. But they do happen, and when they do happen, you've got to be aware and prepared. And I think Ali touched on the point of the fact of visualisation. Mm-hmm. Knowledge is the best thing in this situation.
I mean, before we go on to Merthyr Tydfil and we come away from DFibs and go on to Merthyr, I mean, the one thing for me, though, out of all of this, and yes, the young man's, you know, we've seen pictures today on the Hertford Town Twitter page of the young man sitting up in a hospital bed, you know, and he wouldn't have thought anything happened to him on Saturday. He looks well, and I mean, well in himself, as well as he could be in that sort of situation. But I suppose my thoughts at the moment with it all, I suppose, is how, and it'd be interesting Paul's point of view with this, and maybe Ali's as well on the pitch. How does you then go into your next game, whenever that will be for the two clubs? You know, all of a sudden a player goes down on the floor, and it might just be from a tackle or whatever else. The thought process of those players that played in that game's, you know, head, you know, and also as well the fans that might have seen the incident that happened on Saturday as well. How long does something like that sort of, you know, how long do you think it'll be before those players and maybe even those supporters will have a clear enough mind to be able to go in and enjoy a game of football again? Paul?
Oh, that's a tough question, I think, isn't it? I think it'd probably be different for each individual, but I think some people wouldn't even notice, wouldn't know that they're not ready maybe for a certain period of time there as well. And I think it's difficult to say, isn't it? I'm not sure personally, but I think they'd need to be well over a week there of being away from the situation and not putting yourself back in that situation, just so that you can allow yourself to really take in what's happened and move on from it. But I'm not sure really in terms of how much support people would need and how much time they would need before going back into that situation. Certainly, you know, I haven't, touch wood, haven't been in that situation. And, you know, I don't know if I'd be ready a week later if it was somebody that I had a very, very close relationship with. And obviously, it is easier provided that, you know, in these recent cases, the guys have been okay. And you know, we all accept that things happen in life, and there's got to be come a point where, you know, we want to get back into the things that we enjoy, and football will be no different. But in terms of knowing how long before you'd go back in, I'm not sure. And some people might need to take a little bit longer. And I think we need an environment and a culture where that's okay. And I think it's creeping into sport, and things like Ben Stokes taking time away from the England cricket captaincy, saying I'm not right at the moment. You know, we need to make sure that football has an environment that if whatever it is that's affecting somebody, that they feel that they could say that and have a break and take longer. And I'd like to think then that if a club as a whole felt that they needed longer, that they'd be given, you know, the time that they need to get to get back out there on the football pitch, which ultimately everybody would want to do eventually anyway. But in terms of, I guess it would be different for each individual, and I'm not sure exactly what the time
is. I think it might be a case as well, Paul, wouldn't it? I suppose maybe making, just, I would have thought just from the clubs and maybe from the league in general, just making sure, I mean, the clubs probably more than the league because they will get to see the players on a closer basis, but just making sure that, you know, some of these players, even when they come back into training, and if that's tomorrow for the clubs or if that's Thursday for the clubs or whatever, when they see these players again, just to sort of almost have some kind of trained person maybe there, just to sort of, you know, have that chat with some of the players. Do you know what I mean? Some of the ones that just don't look right and where it's been affected, and not just sort of leave it and just think, well, they'll be all right on Saturday, or they'll be all right the following Saturday or the following Saturday. I think now's the time for maybe them to really keep a close eye on the players that are actually in that ground, and just making sure that you know, they're sort of mentally okay to carry on in the near future. Would you say that, Ali?
Yeah, I 100% agree. I think Paul's hit the nail on the head. It's however long those players need, they can have it, in my personal opinion. So we had an incident last year with Barking, where the opposition keeper got knocked out, one of my players, and it was quite nasty. He was fitting, he was at points not breathing, quite a nasty one. And the player on my team who had unfortunately hit him with his knee was for weeks not right. You know, he was frightened of things. He was worried about going with keepers again. It was a complete accident. You know, these things happen in football, and it took him an awful long time to get over that himself. And there's a lot of like little chats from me saying like, look, it's okay, letting the manager know, this lad needs a little bit more of an arm around him. They maybe need to have a little bit of time training. So I think as long as those players need to give it to them, it's important we have a chat with them. We're all together in this, you know. In terms of a physio, how it affects you, for, I think he never leaves you, David, to be honest. Sadly, I think these moments, they make you a better physio. They make you more aware. You know, I think I've had a few rows on Twitter about, how would you know someone was hurt from so far away? And the answer is because you've seen it before, and you just know it doesn't look right. You know, we've all seen a player collapse, and we all know it's different to them jumping around, screaming and grabbing a knee because they want the penalty. We all know it's different. I can't tell you why it's different, but it is, David. I think that ultimately the physio, when I've had a few bad ones, I know I'm a bit nervous for a few weeks. You know, I'm a bit worried about what might happen next, and I'm a bit nervous about being back on the ground again, and what if it happens again, and what if something worse happens, And yeah. I think that when we had the serious problem when I was at Crane, I'm back now with the anaphylaxis with young Reese, having a really bad problem in the middle of Bristol away, late at night, that I was meant to be off the train station after, because I was going out with my friends, and I cancelled it. I thought it's more important I'm here with the boys, because they needed to have me there. You know, me not being there would have caused them a lot of problems. So I think it's about us as a team getting together, maybe having a little bit of, not team bonding, but having a little chat about it as a team. Making sure that players know what to do next time. But ultimately, we're all human and we're all allowed to feel things about things. And it's important we give everyone in that club space. I think the league, they've cancelled the next game for that team, which I think is a wonderful, if it is, from what I can see, it's a great gesture.
Yeah,
it's wonderful.
Absolutely. I think Anthony Hughes and the rest of the board, you know, at the Southern League, should get some praise for acting very, very quickly and cancelling the games today for both sides, and taking that pressure off of things. I want to get to Keith in as well tonight, so we're going to move on to Paul if I can for a minute, and then come to Keith, because there's been a few people asking me to ask Keith a few questions, so we'll ask him them in a minute. But Paul, I mean, how difficult was it for, you know, I've heard a lot about Murphy through, you know, being friends with Anthony and his absolute love for the club. But how difficult was it at the beginning of the season for you when one minute you thought you might be playing at a lower level, and now all of a sudden you're back into a higher, he's back into the same level? Was it very difficult for the club to prepare?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're still in that kind of stage, because ultimately, when I was appointed earlier in the summer, that we'd set our sights on playing in the league below, and we're now still feeling our way in. You know, we've brought in a lot of players. There's a big blend there at the club, and you know, you can play all the preseason games you like. You don't find out about people until you start playing competitive football at whatever level it is. You know, and so you know, we're still in a stage. We're six games in now. Some players have played today. Who hadn't started a league game for us. And it's important for me. It's important that we give young people an opportunity and young players an opportunity. So I wanted to see a number of players today and see them out there. But ultimately, you don't learn about things until you're into the season. And where we to get a squad for the league below, you know, undoubtedly there are going to be challenges for some of the players psychologically preparing themselves to play at a level that maybe they hadn't played before, having the confidence to step up there that they would have had maybe at that level below. And for us, obviously, we're up against a different level of opposition to what we planned for. So we're still in a kind of stage of feeling our way through that. But ultimately, we take it every day of the week because getting promoted in this pyramid is very, very difficult. You've got to win a league or win a playoff. And, you know, out of 20, 22 team leagues, that takes an unbelievable season. So the reprieve is good for us. You know, it could save us three seasons of trying to get promoted. I look at clubs who had wonderful seasons last season, top of the league all year, and then just dropped into the playoffs and lost in the playoffs, you know, last moment. So, you know, we take the reprieve and it's a great opportunity for us to build on really into this season.
I mean, I was just looking at the fixtures to come and that you've actually got to come. I mean, you must have had a great trip back from Plymouth from Parkway. We were 1-0 win. That's a nice old journey down there and must have been quite a pleasant journey back to come away with a 1-0 win. But then, of course, they share their ground with Truro and all of a sudden you've got them 2 weeks in a row.
Yeah, we are at home for
yeah.
But like the FA Cup draw, I think Paul at Truro said, you know, how he wasn't really happy with the draw. It was a tough draw for them. Well, you know, our step is the highest step to come in at this round, and we've drawn, you know, a team who's top of that step at the moment. So the draw couldn't be any tougher. And we play them home twice. Of course, if we draw on Saturday, then we could be playing them. We could be three times in a week. So, you know, that's the beauty of the non-league. You know, I enjoy the trips, to be honest. And I enjoy that time with the boys and celebrating the wins. And, you know, that's part of it for me. You know, I enjoy being at this level of football for that reason. And, you know, we certainly did enjoy that. It was back-to-back wins and back-to-back clean sheets. So we did enjoy that trip back from Plymouth Parkway. And hopefully there'll be a few more of those during the season.
But I mean, what I suppose the first one was with Tiverton. That's sort of Somerset, isn't it? If I'm right in saying, and then, but the next one's you know, the sort of Plymouth Parkway. That is a fair old journey. I mean, how long did that take to get to there?
Well, we were late. We've been late to every single away fixture. Gosport, our bus broke down. We had a blowout, and that was a crazy story. I don't know if you've seen much of that.
So I had this conversation with Anthony. We did have a laugh about it. But I mean, tell everybody about what happened if people didn't actually know the story.
So obviously the supporters have got behind us over the summer massively, and it's our first game of the season away to Gosport, and we've taken a supporters coach as well. We total, I think we're taking about 90 fans because other people are going by train or going in cars and stuff. We're getting there. We get close to Winchester. I think we're about 50 minutes out from Gosport, and we have a blowout on the dual carriageway there. We pull into the side of the supporters bus, which is a little bit smaller, not quite as nice. And the boys are a little bit well-oiled on their way down to support us. They go flying past us on the dual carriageway. At the time, we thought it was a simple case of a blowout. The drivers called for a company to come and fix the tyre. And the supporters actually straight away said, right, well, we'll get dropped off in Winchester, go for a couple of beers. You take our bus, get to the game, make sure the game goes ahead. And then they'll come down on our bus once the tyre has been repaired. So straight away, you know, there wasn't a thought for the supporters of them not making the game or, you know, if they didn't think twice about giving us their coach. That's the type of club that Merthyr Town is, and the supporters are fantastic. We took a great following away today. And as it so happened, the bus couldn't be repaired at the side, and they ended up going to watch Winchester. on the way back then, the coach was there. We had to have a replacement coach, and the coach was still sat there at 7 o'clock on the way back when we came past it on the way home. So, yeah, the supporters didn't even get to see the game, and they gave us their coach. And that sums up non-league, and that sums up Merthyr Town Football Club, I think.
Oh, just a fantastic story. And in all fairness, you know, football, you know, in your part of the world, he's buzzing at the minute. What's going on with Wrexham as well, and all the rest of it. So it's all really buzzing down there. But I mean, tell us a little bit about the club. I mean, you know, as you know, Anthony Hughes is a massive fan, and you know, at the club and that. And I mean, he sort of, I think, worships the ground everybody walks on in that club. I think he loves it so much. So, I mean, but tell us a little bit about, you know, Merthyr Town itself.
Well, certainly with Anthony, I think the feeling's mutual. I think everybody in the club holds him in very, very high regard as well. There's no doubt about that. Well, for me, you know, it's Merthyr Town and Merthyr Tydfil before it, as I've always seen it as, you know, the biggest clubs in non-league in Wales. And you know, he's obviously been through some tough times, financial difficulties, the Merthyr Tydfil going bust, and then Merthyr Town coming back to the forefront and working its way back up the leagues. And yeah, to me, it's just always been, you've had the Football League clubs. You know, I grew up when probably Newport were just above Merthyr or a very similar level. Wrexham were always in the Football League at that time. And then, so you'd see Wrexham, Cardiff, Swansea, and then it was Newport and Merthyr for me. And so, you know, there's lots going on in the background. In Wales, you'll hear a lot of casual observers saying they should Merthyr should join the Welsh Pyramid and stuff like that. But the supporters are... they absolutely love being in the pyramid that they're in. They love being in the non-league. They love the history that the club has in these leagues. And they're determined to continue to play and to progress back up the pyramid now as Merthyr Town. So it's a very passionate town for football. You know, there are supporters there that in many communities in South Wales, you'll have lots of people who support Cardiff City or Swansea City, and they go down to the games. In Merthyr, there's so many people who support Merthyr Town. That is their football club. And at this level of football, you don't often get the same level of passion that you do from Merthyr Town supporters and at Merthyr Town Football Club.
And I mean, yeah, I mean, I'm just looking at you. I mean, your average crowds were over 500 as well. So, you know, very well supported as well.
Yeah, and I think that'll grow, you know, with success, that'll grow. I mean, obviously last season the club finished second bottom and should have been relegated, and they have still up there. And this season we haven't had an amazing start. We've been okay. And we're a bit clear of that relegation zone at the moment. There's plenty of room for us to grow, but the supporters are still there. They're still turning up. And I think on bank holidays and in big games, I think we'll be well up towards 1,000. And if we can bring success to them, I know they'll come out and support the football club. So that's part of the draw for me. You know, I've always seen it as a huge club, and you know, I think the supporters make that really as much as anyone.
Mm. I mean, it's a big thing this year as well, and it's four down this year as well. So it's a lot of, it's a big old relegation zone this year as well.
Yeah, back to what it should be really. And there should be movement between the pyramids, between each step of the pyramid. That's good for football and good for the standard of football. So, you know, we know what's the task that's in front of us, and I'm really confident in what we've got this season. That is, you know, we've had a tough start. We've played some, I don't think we've played many teams who are going to be near the bottom of the league yet. And, you know, today I don't think there was much between the teams. They've got 12 points, we've only got 6. That's football, isn't it? And it's fine margins, but I'm really confident that we can, you know, we can continue to develop and finish well clear of that four down, really.
Mm. I mean, the club itself, though, I mean, is it just... I'm assuming from what Andy says, you've got plenty of kids' teams and any ladies' sides and stuff in the clubs as well?
Yeah, I mean, we've just started the academy again. So the club had an academy in the past, and they've only just been reissued Football Association of Wales Academy status, which is huge because we've got to offer opportunities for... the young people of Merthyr to play at a higher standard above grassroots football. There's a lot of change going on in Welsh football at the moment in terms of this move to academy football, and one player can now only play for one club as if they'd gone to, say, a Cardiff or a Swansea academy. There's more contact time in these in these other clubs' academies to try and develop players for the future. And it'd be great to develop more players from Merthyr and you know, in the town itself to play for the first team. But in terms of there's walking football teams, there's ladies' teams. It's a real hub for everyone in the community. Everyone can play football at Merthyr Town. There's six-a-side recreational leagues on the 3G pitch. It's a real success story in terms of the community, that football is for everybody. There's ladies' teams, there's men's teams, there's academy teams, there's walking football teams, and it's somewhere that everyone can enjoy the beautiful game.
So you didn't put a bid in for Gareth Bale then?
No, that would have been good. We could have kept him fit definitely till the World Cup, but I think our plastic couple off. I think he was going to come back, actually.
But I mean, with that now, I mean, are you a fan of the plastic as such, or are you a grass man?
Yeah, I mean, it just guarantees you a good surface all year round at this level. I mean, Keith talked about money filtering down from the Premier League, and of course, a perfect grass surface. I think everybody would probably prefer that. But when you drop down the pyramid and the amount of funding and care and attention that takes, and there are a number of people who look after grass pitches across the country and devote so much time to it. You know, they deserve so much respect, but this offers us an opportunity to be a real community hub and to have those things like walking football, women's academy teams all playing at a lovely venue, to be fair. It's a brilliant stadium there for the community, and that plastic pitch allows that. So I think at certain levels of football, I think it is the way forward. It's certainly exploded in Wales in terms of plastic pitches. And it does mean that football clubs can become a real community hub, and everybody can get enjoyment out of the game that we all love.
Well, you just said, I mean, I'll leave you with this thing for you. About the 29th of October, you go away to probably one of the places or one of the grounds that has almost got a perfect grass pitch, and that's Hamwell Town.
Right.
It's like a carpet. So I've been told it's an absolute carpet. So the guy down there, where it will be on the 29th of October. What the weather's like.
I'll have to let you know that day. I'll let you know if there's a carpet or not.
Listen, Paul, we really do appreciate you giving your time and, you know, coming up, and especially after, you know, the trip to Swindon Supermarine today and all this. And do wish you and Murphy all the very, very best for the season. We really do. And I hope you, get up that table and hopefully even get into those sort of playoff positions this year, because it's a fantastic club. And we wish you all the very best. And a massive thank you for coming on and giving up your time, when all you want to do is get home to the family. So we'll let you go so you can get back to the family. But a massive thank you for giving us your time tonight.
Oh, no, thank you. Thanks for having me on in such great company. And I'll flick Keith on. I'll certainly turn it back on now and listen to Keith.
I mean, literally, you can stay. I was just more concerned about yourself getting onto the phone. If you want to stay with us for the next 10 minutes or so, you're more than welcome to stay with us. So no.
I want to hear Keith.
Yeah. So Keith, I mean, one of the things I get again today, you know, I'm part of sort of like the Harlow Town Forum, and I've seen things on there today that, you know, the referee today was absolutely, you know, atrocious. The referee was this, the referee was that, blah, 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 you know, and they lost 2-1. So I know we've spoken about it when we had the conversation about your life in football, but I mean, where do you see the standard of refereeing in this country at the moment, maybe at our level? Do you see it as it's improving? Do you feel it's staying level, or do you think it has got worse?
I think that it's disjointed. And I think the FA, the Football Association, have got a lot of work to do. There's a massive shortage. You know, we as a club, I mean, I'm president of Penistone Church. We have 20 teams. We don't have a plastic pitch, which is a pity, because a lot of our teams have to play in school grounds away from our clubhouse, which loses revenue for us. I think that when I took up refereeing, it was free. I did 6 evenings, I volunteered, and I became a referee. The first barrier that the FA have put up is £146 is the cost of going through an exam and becoming a referee. So what happens? It's a barrier. Some kids can't afford it. parents can't afford to pay the kids to do it. So I think that with the money in the FA, that should be free as it used to be. So there's a shortage of referees. Now I think that we get into the area of refereeing generally. And you know, the game has moved on. The game is quicker. Therefore, I think I worry about the fitness levels of some of my colleagues. They need to be fit for purpose. I've talked in the past that the expectation of a referee at the elite level is to run 11,500 meters per game on average, to do 1,000 meters at 7 meters per second, and to make decisions. Now, as the former boss of the PGMOL, I had sports scientists, I had analysts, I had sports psychologists, vision scientists, and other health medics around the referees at the elite level. That to some degree has cascaded down, but not far enough. So there has to be an opportunity for a youngster like myself. When I was 16, I'd had no vision of becoming a Premier League or an international referee. It was a little bit through my own steam and the encouragement that I received from people around the club. What we've got now, I think, is a lot of people coming into the game for the wrong reasons. And I think then we've got a system that creates too many barriers for allowing that intelligent, top quality individual to move through the system quickly. And there's too many, if you like, fences within the system to accelerate someone through a career. Now, you've got to understand that the apprenticeship is about 8 to 12 years. I mean, I was a grassroots referee for 12 years before I stepped onto a Football League ground. When we get to grassroots football, the biggest problem at the actual young age group, it's parents. It's abuse. And therefore, we see referees come in, they pay the 146 quid, the last six games and disappear. And so what we've got is we've got almost a sort of leagues with referees who are at that age that should be considering hanging the boots up and moving into the 60s and 70s. You know, we need fit, mobile, athletic individuals who can manage individuals. And so it's getting those referees coached and trained to perform well. But in it, there's got to be truth. There's got to be accountability. You know, when a referee makes an error, he's got to be told it's an error. And then if you're told how to avoid it in the future. So I think it's a bit hit and miss. I saw a referee a couple of weeks ago. I've been in contact with him since. I thought he was absolutely superb. And then he's only been refereeing a few years. And okay, I'm going to link with this guy because I want to see his full potential materialize at the top level, as I did with Mark Clattenburg, as I did with Howard Webb and other referees. So I think that they need support. They need the proper support. And they need to be operating at a level that they are suitable for. Because there's a shortage. What you get is some referees' careers being accelerated and they suddenly find themselves into a top-level game and there the game changes. You're not refereeing two teams of 11. You're actually having to manage an event. You're having to, you know, deal with the spectators. And how do you deal with them psychologically? How do you get over that error, you know? An error on the football field for a referee has to be parked up very quickly and to move on. But then what you've got to do afterwards is analyse that error and determine how you can avoid it in the future. So I think that we're in various points in the country, we have some fine, outstanding officials coming through. They're being held up. They're not getting that drive that says, we want you on the Football League. And then in other parts of the country, there's just a dearth of talent. You know, there's just lacking in the actual promotion of referees. We're going into the wrong people, all those sort of things. And then, of course, the other thing is we're beginning to see women referees coming in at the higher level. And you know, some of them that are there are faced with abuse because, they, you know, it's a man's game. Well, it isn't. It's everybody's game. And those issues have to be addressed by the authorities and by the clubs themselves. We've got to encourage people to behave a little bit better. You know, okay, I think that we accept that when we go in the game as referees, we're not going to be loved. In many cases, we're going to be hated. And, you know, the spectators pay the money to show. It's when they start throwing objects and then the threats come. And players who are out of control and misbehaved, that makes life difficult for a referee.
Did you find it, I mean, sort of a couple of questions. What, I suppose, first question, he's, you know, a good friend of yours. I mean, you know, and has he called you yet, Mr. Of course, Mr. Howard Webb, now, of course, going to be in charge of the PGMOL. And how refreshing was it to see the Fulham striker come out, Mitrovic come out in the Arsenal game and actually say that, you know, that when he was giving the referee a bit of abuse, he's now seen it back on video and was almost apologetic and actually saying that he got it wrong.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the nature of football, I think, that often the referee understands and applies the laws and the players play the game. And sometimes their law knowledge is biased. You know, that's the very nature of a player. And I would want them that way. I think it's great that a player has a review of the situation. I wish some managers would do that on occasions. But it's about communication, you know. It's about having that. Yeah, one of the things that I find in rugby that's different to football is in rugby there's a social mix. The referee at the end of the match goes into the clubhouse, has a couple of beers if he's not driving, and has a chat about his performance. And people can ask questions. That has to be there in terms of the referee. And I think sometimes when a referee does have a good performance, he should be encouraged. And you know, as I used to run alongside the likes of Gascoigne and, you know, Pelé and others, sometimes when they had a go at me, I would say, well, you've made a poor pass or you've missed that goal when you should have scored. I think there's all ways of communicating with players. Some that are, of course, are not repeatable on this program.
But I mean, we're having a full conversation here, Paul and Ali, and Keith's dropping in Gascoigne and Pelé.
I know.
I mean, it's like, you know.
Pelé, yeah. Yeah. Pelé, you can't pass.
Yeah. But as Howard contacted you, you know, in any way, shape or form to ask for your advice, you know, around his new position?
We will have a cup of coffee. And I've had an email, but I sent him a congratulatory email. I was aware that he'd been approached, but when I spoke to him on the phone, he hadn't had the contract. He's now got that contract. He's signed it. You know, he's got a tough task ahead. I think that although I thought at the weekend some referees had good games, we're not at the world-class end of refereeing as far as I'm concerned. There's a couple who are, but the rest have got to catch up. There's some that need to be put out to grass, putting it bluntly. Therefore, I think that he's got to come in and you know, do a root and branch review. I was amazed that, you know, a referee that I've criticised, John Moss, suddenly became the manager of the SG1. I think he should be kept a million miles away from them because the game has changed. It demands fitness, mobility. You know, I say again that the process of a referee is quite simple. You see, you recognise, you think, and you act. And if you go through that process, often referees' shortfall in accuracy is because they're not in the right position at the right time. And so he's got some work to do. He's a great personality, but he's also got some organisational challenges, which, in my opinion, would see some people moving on. Unlike a football manager, takes over a club and brings his team coach, if you like, the coach full of staff. Howard's got to rejig it and find. I hope that he brings or he can encourage Greg Barkew's the guy who's run VAR in America very successfully. I'd like to see him come and deal with that role within the PGMOL.
Well, all I would say is one referee this during midweek, and all the best to him, because it's not the greatest, you know, not the game I think I'd want to be refereeing as a referee, but all the best to Peter Banks, because he's got a referee West Ham, but he's Tottenham on Wednesday night. That could be a bit of a humdinger as well.
Well, yeah, and I have to say that I was surprised that the PGMOL announced week 4 and week 5 appointments at the same time. You know, this weekend, I don't think Peter Banks had his best game, if I'm honest. And now he's going into that game. And we know that that's always going to be a tough physical game. He allowed a lot to go in the Newcastle clash. And let's hope he just tightens up a little bit and maintains control rather than let it go away from him as it did at the weekend at times.
I suppose one question as well, you know, when you get this, would you like to see, if money was no object, Paul, would you like to see VAR down at Merthyr?
Wow. Yeah, I think so, because it adds, well, you'd like to think it adds an increase in correct decisions. And ultimately, the more correct decisions, the happier everybody is, isn't it? I think a lot of people enjoy the entertainment of, you know, some people have said VAR has withdrawn from the entertainment because it's part and parcel, people getting things wrong. But I think ultimately those of us who play and coach football want as many correct decisions as possible. I don't know whether to mention at this point that I was sent off today for the second time in my career. And
come on. You do, Paul?
but yes.
I hope that at some point you'll have a chat with the referee, because I think the referee, in those situations, I feel there's a step process and a calming down that's required on during the game, because managers are passionate. And, you know, if you look at the Thomas Tuchel example recently where he's charging down the pitch, he was allowed to do that. And every time he did that, he was breaking the laws of the game. He needed a quiet word in his ear to say, look, not necessarily calm down, because passion's part of the game, but to put some form of controlling, if you like, management into it by the match officials. There is a step process. There's a quiet word. Yeah. There's a more public word. Then there's a yellow card, and then there's a red card. Mm. And I feel sometimes the step management by referees, they go to confrontation as the route to an answer to win the argument, when I think the challenge ought to be, can you manage this fiery individual on this occasion? And can you avoid the ultimate, if you like, punishment? I have to tell you that in a 23-year career at the very top level, and I was seen to be a tough referee, I only sent 10 players off in that period, because I always went in with a view that, if you think of a boiling kettle, and this you might use with your players, if the boiling, what you've got to do is you want to keep it bubbling, because the game's brilliant at that level. When it's bubbling, everybody's into it and everybody's passionate, and the referee's out of it and he's allowing the game to flow, let it bubble. If you let it cool, then if you're in, that means that you're interfering too often. You're not allowing the game to breathe. It's a blow, blow, blow until the point everybody's bored about you because you're becoming center stage. It's recognizing as a referee when that boiling point comes. And that's when you increase your management processes and frustrate to some degree a little bit. That means when you start to see the odd free kick and give it, you tighten up on the control of the players. And you can do that for 4 or 5 minutes and win it back, the control. So I think often the coaching of referees at various levels, they're not putting in sufficient training and coaching about managing the event, managing the two teams that's in front of them, managing the players, and managing those that are surrounding the pitch, trying to control the players. And I think that all too often, you know, there's some times when I think at junior football and seeing it, you know, my club's in step 4-5. I believe that in many instances, I would take the red and yellow cards away from them because I don't think it promotes the management side of refereeing. I used to use sports psychologists to deal with body language. I've seen referees who as an assessor and as a coach and as a boss of referees, look to be arrogant. And I used to say to the sports psychologists, how can we get that out of him? How can we actually reduce? And how can we get this referee to go back and be human rather than inhuman on the field of play? But I could go on length about it. I'd bore you about it.
No, no. Shall we ask?
You can run for PM and I'll vote for you at this point, mate. Just go for it.
should we ask Paul what he got sent off for?
Yeah, he dodged it a minute ago.
I think I deserve to be sent off today. I've got a saying that I try and go back to all the time. If the game comes down to a refereeing decision, then you haven't done enough to win the game anyway. And I try and live by that as much as I can. And I apologize to the referee after the game today for my outburst. And my issue today was it was that bubbling point, I guess, where I just felt there were massive inconsistencies in that one level of contact that was being given and then the same level of contact wasn't being given. And the referee actually did have that human side. Because at halftime, he said to my assistant that, yeah, there was contact in the box on your player, but it wasn't enough for a penalty.
You're really upsetting me here because at the weekend, we had a very clear shirt pull on a player.
Yeah.
Against a Newcastle player.
Yeah, I saw that.
And
it was said about it.
And you know, we had that. We had the handball that prevented Harry Kane knocking the ball in the back of the net. And then what we heard was the pull wasn't enough.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is a PGMOL spokesperson saying this. And I was just pulling my hair out. I mean, I was due to go on radio and said, look, don't have me on the next 30 minutes because I'll go ape. And because I'm a South Yorkshire lad, I say it as it is. What abject nonsense in the game of football when a player has clearly pulled his opponent and some idiot that's involved in refereeing says that's not a foul and not a penalty kick. And at the same time, justifying why the referee didn't give the penalty kick and why the VAR didn't come in. I'll tell you, that is awful officiating, awful, and way below the standard of professional refereeing required in this country. A foul is a foul is a foul. And I'm hearing in recent days, we've raised the bar. And all that the raising the bar has done, it's confusing me. And with 50 years of experience in refereeing, and I'm not being arrogant here, if it's confusing me, it's confusing referees. And if it's confusing referees, managers and players and spectators are utterly and totally confused. With regard to VAR, until the panel is ex-referees or ex-managers and referees or ex-players and referees, the VAR in this country will never operate to the standard we expect because they're matey, they're pals. I don't want to drop my mate into the mire, so I'm not coming in. Or you get a young referee who's new on the block, suddenly running or being VAR in a room locked away somewhere, totally remote from the game, telling a guy who's going to a World Cup that he's got it wrong. That relationship at the moment is not right. And as a result of that, we get this, is he coming in? Is he not coming in? And I can tell you, as someone that's been involved in refereeing, I just shudder. You know, I spent 2 days in a country this week with the leagues and with the managers and owners of a league, talking to them about how they can get rid of corruption. Fortunately, in this country, it does not exist. But what we do have is a lack of accountability. You know, Paul will tell you that if he's number nine, he's not putting the ball in the back of the net. He'll put extra training into that number nine. He'll talk to the players around him so that he's delivering the ball much better to allow that number nine to put the ball in the back of the net. right? If referees aren't performing, then if the number nine doesn't perform, having had all that coaching, he's dropped. Now, what Paul can do is take him off at half-time or take him off during the course of the game, substitute him. We can't do that with refereeing, which is unfortunate, because there are some times when I think the referee should be subbed because he's having a bad game. Mm. I think it requires honesty. What VAR has brought to this country is lazy refereeing. And do you know, it's less than 2 years ago that Nigel Owens, probably the greatest rugby referee, said to me, Keith, it will bring and develop and promote lazy refereeing. And I see it. I see referees now looking and listening and not doing the job because the concentration is not 100%. So, yeah.
What a great way to finish the show, because I can honestly say to you, we've done 299 shows and I don't think I've enjoyed one as much as I've enjoyed tonight. So I can honestly say you three today, Ali, Keith, Paul, have been absolutely outstanding. Some great subjects covered tonight, from defibs to refereeing to the, you know, to a fantastic club like Merthyr Town as well. It's been absolutely fantastic as well. The one thing, of course, two things to finish with. One, just don't forget this weekend, if you win a game of football over the weekend before we meet again on Monday, don't celebrate. Because, of course, you're not allowed to celebrate winning anything anymore in football, according to two dinosaurs off of BM Sports. But also as well, next week, of course, is show 300. I can't believe that we've been doing the show for 11 years. I can't believe we're actually going to reach 300 shows this time next week. And joining us next week, there's a long list of people, and hopefully the internet holds up, because there's a lot of people coming on next week. There's the unbelievable Ali will be back with us next week. Keith will be with us, of course, next week. And then there's a big list. There's Carl Bates, who is works for the BBC, works for Millwall Football Club as well. He was one of the first co-presenters with me of the show. Also as well is Migsy, of course, the first co-presenter with me on the show. We've also got Nick Robinson, the chairman of the Isthmian League. He's going to come and join us. My great friend, somebody that I think the world of, and he knows that. Of course, Anthony, he's coming on with us next week, of course, the chairman of the Southern League, and of course, Merthyr Town super fan. He'll be along to join us. And of course, Nick Bowler as well. He used to be part of our show from the very beginning, where we used to go to him every single week and talk about the clubs in Norfolk and Suffolk. He's going to be back with us next week. We're trying to get Steve Gardner. We're trying to get the legend that is Mr. Tony Gow. He's not returning my calls at the minute, but hopefully we can get him. And he'll be with us, of course, next week as well. But a massive thank you. Please join in next week. Please spread the word, 300. It's going to be a great show next week, full of laughs and fun. But as I said, guys, thank you very much for tonight. It's been an absolute blast of a show. Really, really enjoyed it. And I'm going to have to try and get to a Merthyr game as soon as I possibly can. I'm going to try and book a holiday in Wales and get to a Merthyr game. But Keith, it's been fantastic chat. Hopefully we can get you on again very soon as well. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And I know Keith would love to have a chat with you as well when he's available and back with us from next week. And Ali, it's always a pleasure to be talking to you, and we'll see you next week. But from everybody that's been watching tonight, a massive thank you. Please make sure you let everybody know that, believe it or not, 11 years, 299 shows, and there's still teams out there that don't know that we've been doing this for 11 years. So please spread the word, and we'll be back next week for the Repo show next week. But for tonight, from everybody that's here, a massive thank you and good night.